Should we barge on towards 10 o'clock?
Second thing is to give a little introduction to the news, to positive psychology and the new scientific pursuit of happiness. First, let me give you a little count I've done of the appearance of selected negative versus positive words in psychological abstracts since 1887. I could find 135,000 abstracts mentioning the word depression, and fewer than 8,000 mentioning happiness. There is 43,000 on fear, 2,000 on its opposite, courage. There's 18,000 on anger, and there's fewer than 3,000 on joy. And it was in response to that imbalance that Martin Seligman, about 15 years ago, proposed a more positive psychology for the 21st century. What Marty Seligman said is that it's important to study depression, anxiety, stress, anger, and the things that make for and can relieve these conditions. That's an important task for psychological science and clinical psychology. But it's also important to study accentuating the positive end of the domain. And in particular, he suggested that we focus on three legs of a new positive psychology in the 21st century. First, what we'll talk about here in the next half hour, which is the study of positive subjective well-being, meaning a sense of satisfaction with life, feelings of happiness, an optimistic outlook. Also, we should be studying and learning how to cultivate positive strengths and virtues, such as creativity, courage, compassion, integrity, wisdom, self-control, spirituality, forgiveness, hope, and the like. And third, we should be thinking collectively about how to create and nurture healthy families, pro-social media, effective schools, and the like. And so I got drawn into this because I had written a book in the early 1990s entitled The Pursuit of Happiness. By the way, what happens is I read psychological science, particularly from my introductory psychology textbook, is I sometimes come across information that strikes me as so interesting, so humanly significant, that not just university students, but everybody, I think, should know about this. And from that comes an urge to write. And that was the case as I started reading this new scientific literature pertaining to happiness. And so then when Marty Seligman proposed the positive psychology movement, he invited me along with Mihai Csikszentmihalyi and some other more senior people, Ed Diener and others, to come together along with some junior scholars. And we started out for a week at a lagoon near Cancun, Mexico, snorkeling in the afternoons and talking about different positive psychology topics with this new network of young scholars. And out of that has grown just an enormously successful effort that has now drawn, I think now, tens of millions of dollars in funding, new journals, handbooks of positive psychology, even textbooks, hundreds of articles. Here, by the way, somebody has done a wordle of some of the words appearing in different recent issues of the Journal of Positive Psychology, one of the journals that came out of this, and you can see some of the various topics. These are positive psychology topics that appear in one of my own introductory psychology textbooks, from altruism, coping, courage, creativity, emotional intelligence, down at the bottom to spirituality, which is on his list, grit and wisdom. My focus in particular is on happiness. And this has been a topic of rapidly increasing interest, as you can see here from the number of articles appearing annually and indexed by PsycINFO. And so I got my inspiration as I saw this emerging in the late 80s, and I authored this book that came out of the early 1990s. Another person has indexed articles appearing in the psychological literature. This is in the Journal of Positive Psychology, and you can see the increase on topics like, this is the whole psychological literature, on self-efficacy, engagement, happiness, meaning, all these things have just gone up dramatically in the last 10 years as areas of study. So let's step back. I said subjective well-being. What is it? How would you assess it? Well, there's a variety of ways. We have multi-item questionnaires that we can give people. We can attach pagers to people, sampling their moment-to-moment experience and asking them to report their mood states. We can ask some very simple, direct questions. Here's one that's been put to hundreds of thousands of people in a straightforward survey. Taking all things together, how would you say things are these days? Would you say you're very happy, pretty happy, or not too happy? Related to happiness, sort of like oranges are related to tangerines, is life satisfaction, but it's somewhat more cognitive. So, for example, how satisfied are you with your life as a whole these days? Completely satisfied? Fairly satisfied? Not very satisfied? Not at all satisfied? First question. When we put questions like this to people, how happy are they? How happy do they report themselves being? How satisfied with their lives? I first started reading some of the mental health literature books on happiness and was struck by the number of books that were telling me that few people are genuinely happy. A third of Americans wake up depressed each day and so forth. These were written by people who spend their days counseling deeply unhappy people and seem to generalize from their client population. In fact, if you go out to random samples of people across the industrialized world, you find that their self-reports are mostly pretty positive. For example, for an article we had in Scientific American, Ed Diener aggregated data from 916 surveys of 1.1 million people in 45 nations. And for this particular graph, what he did is recalibrate the well-being responses to a 0 to 10 continuum, where 0 is life is miserable, I'm very unhappy, dissatisfied, 5 is neutral, and 10 is I am so happy, I am just blessed to be alive. Joy just spreads across my face. Here's the average human response across these 45 nations, averaging about 7 on the 0 to 10 continuum, with very few, as you can see, below the midpoint of the scale. Or, to put the question in Britain, here's the distribution of life satisfaction among British people, some 75,000 surveyed over a 7-year period. On a 7-point scale, people were asked to rate themselves. Most people give themselves a 5 or a 6, near the top of the distribution. At Southern Methodist University, David Watson interrupted 226 students more than 10,000 times and asked them what kind of a mood they were in right now, just to describe how they were feeling. About 4.5% of the time, they reported feeling some strong negative emotion, and 4 times as often, they reported feeling some strong positive emotion, which predominated over negative emotion. Gallup interrupted Americans and asked them what kind of a mood they were in, and more than 4 in 5 said they were in a good mood when interrupted, despite being interrupted. The University of Michigan asked people in my state, which of these faces describe how you feel about life as a whole? And as you can see, more than 9 in 10 picked some variation on a smiling, happy face. Only 3% gave a frowning face to describe how they felt about life as a whole, which might roughly correspond with the number of people experiencing at least mild or moderate depression at any given time. Just recently, within the last week or two, the Gallup World Poll came out with new data from their worldwide surveys in which they asked people, yesterday, did you feel well-rested? Did you get treated with respect? Did you smile or laugh? Did you learn or do something interesting? Did you experience enjoyment? And what I'm going to show you is the percentage of people in different countries who answered yes to every one of those questions. And we start at the top with Paraguay and Venezuela, where 86% said yes, 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 yes. And then not too far down the list, we come to Norway, and just after that, the United States. And then at the bottom of the list, we come to Iraq and Syria. It's understandable. Life's a little miserable in Iraq and Syria right now. But what really strikes me is that half of the people of Iraq and Syria feel well-rested, feel treated with respect, smile and laugh yesterday, despite their miserable circumstance. By the way, what amazes me about this is that in 2013, Gallup was able to do a comprehensive survey of representative samples of the people in those countries. Well, you may wonder, can we trust these self-reports? I mean, come on, really? Aren't some of these happy people just maybe in denial of their own inner misery and pathology? And there may be something to that. The happiness thermometers probably do read a little high, because people in surveys tend to over-report good things and under-report bad things. In national surveys, people in my country tend to under-report their smoking of cigarettes. That is, if we generalize from the survey answer and compare that to the number of cigarettes actually sold. They over-report voting. More people claim to vote than have actually voted in national elections. And yet, these are still interesting questions for comparing the relatively happy and relatively unhappy people. And these self-report measures are fairly reliable over time. As people are questioned, then questioned again later. They're correlated with samplings of people's experience. So if you tell me you're a very happy person, the odds are that if we sample your moment-to-moment moods over a week's time, and aggregate those momentary self-reports, we'll get a similar result from the two methods. They're correlated with other positive indicators of well-being, such as how happy you look, how much you smile, and they're correlated with others' reports. If you say you're a very happy person, the odds are that people that know you will tend to think that, yeah, she is a pretty happy person. And finally, remember that what we're studying is subjective well-being, for which, by definition, the final authority for you is the person that lives inside your skin. If you think you're a very happy person or a very unhappy person, by our operational definition, you are, because you're the authority on you. And think about it this way. If somebody says at the other end of the continuum, I'm depressed, they look depressed, their momentary mood reports are depressed, their family members think they're depressed, wouldn't you like believe them? Would you say to them, I don't believe you, I think you're just denying, repressing your deep inner joy. No, we take people seriously, and that's why you're training. You're taking professional degrees to become helping, caring professionals. And so taking these self-reports seriously, and for good reason, we can now ask the big question. So who's happy? What would I need to know to predict whether you or somebody you're thinking about right now would describe their life as marked by happiness and satisfaction? Would it help me to know their age? Is there any association between age and well-being? Here are data harvested from representative national surveys in Europe and North America primarily, 16 nations, 170,000 persons, showing us the percentage of people who are at least fairly satisfied with life as a whole as a function of their age. And as you can see, there's essentially no age effect. There's a few miserable, relatively small proportion of miserable, and a larger proportion of satisfied people at every age. Despite the fact that there are some age-related trends in specific domains of life satisfaction. So marital satisfaction, for example, has an interesting U-shaped curve across four different studies. Starts out high during the honeymoon period. I don't know if you can read this, but this is kind of a low point for many couples, teenagers 12 to 16. And then for those relationships that survive to the empty nest period, happiness increases. My colleague Daniel Gilbert, who's written another book, a wonderful book on happiness, Stumbling on Happiness, says the only known symptom of an empty nest is a smiling face. So looking, if age doesn't give me a clue, what about gender? Are women happier because of their supposed greater capacity for social connection, intimacy, empathy? Are men happier because of their greater social power and income historically? Here are data again from the 16-nation, 170,000 person study, showing us the percentage of fairly satisfied, let's take that a little more slowly, a fairly satisfied men and women. And then if we raise the bar and ask who's very happy, we see once again that the answer is essentially identical for men and women. There's just no gender difference to speak of. And this is kind of curious, because as many of you are students of clinical psychology, you're well aware that there is a difference in psychiatric disorder. But first, I forgot I had another slide here. This is a cool slide. These are data. By the way, this talk has some big data slide, what are called big data pieces of information. Here are data from 608,000 randomly sampled Americans over a two-year period by the Gallup organization, which calls up 1,000 randomly sampled Americans every day. This is the percent who said that during a lot of the day yesterday, they experienced happiness, enjoyment, and smiling or laughter. And you see the data for women, the lighter green, and men, the darker green. And as you can see, until you get to the late 80s and early 90s, there's just no gender difference in answering that question. So it's just confirmation. And yet, you surely are aware that men are half as vulnerable to a disabling depression as are women. You perhaps are aware that schizophrenia knows very little gender preference. It's only slightly more common among men than it is among women. Alcoholism, however, is 4 times more common among men than among women. Antisocial conduct disorder is 8 times more common among men than women. The late Susan Nolan Hoeksema said in so many words, "Tell me somebody's gender and I'll make a prediction as to whether when there's stress and difficulty in their life, they're likely to overthink, to ruminate, and to become anxious or depressed, which women are more likely to do, because they tend to," she says, "overthink," or she said, "or whether they're more likely to drink or act out." That's something men are more likely to do when faced with stress. Okay, some interesting gender-related differences in disorder, but overall happiness is about the same between the sexes. What about money? We're in pursuit of happiness. Some people are much happier than others, and we haven't yet found any great predictor. There is the presumption that money buys happiness. Would you be happier if you made more money? Yes, said 3/4 of Americans, and that was before the recent recession. These are data, again, I apologize for these data, happen to be American data, but this is a really cool slide because these data, there's about 14, something like 13 million subjects represented in this slide. The UCLA, in cooperation with the American Council on Education, has surveyed about 250,000 entering collegians each year in the United States. And among the questions they've asked them is, what's, you know, very important or essential? Is it very important or essential that you develop a meaningful philosophy of life? And that's the pattern of answers over the last 50, nearly half century now. While the percent who said it's very important or essential that they be very well off financially flip-flopped with that. And in fact, last fall, just a year ago, was the number one ranked in a goal among 19 life goals, outranking other important things like raising a family, helping others in difficulty, becoming an expert in one's profession. Important things, but more important yet was becoming very well off financially. This is materialistic modern America. So we think that there is some connection between money and well-being. It's been called the American dream. Number one, get lots of happiness. Number two, exchange that money for goods and services. And then number three, sit back and enjoy the good life, says this New Yorker cartoon. So what's the evidence? Does money buy happiness? Well, we can triangulate on this. First, by asking if people are happier if they live in rich rather than poor, or at least not so rich countries. And we have a number of studies that have done exactly what this one shows. I'm just going to show you one slide in the interest of time. On the horizontal x-axis, we have gross domestic product per capita. That's an economist's measure of kind of average national purchasing power. And as you can see, leading the way up here is Norway in the upper right. And on the vertical axis, we have the average self-reported life satisfaction of people in these countries. Now, if you look at these data, you first of all see there's some upward slope. There is, in fact, some positive correlation between national wealth and national well-being. You can also see that correlation tapers off if we look at just that kind of section up here, once you get above, well, $15,000 or so per person. There's not much correlation with increased wealth above that. Moreover, these countries in the upper right, the Scandinavian countries, North American, other Western European countries, are not just wealthy countries. They're also countries that have given their people empowerment. There's a long history of stable democracy. There's high levels of education. We have a number of confounded variables. So which of these is accounting for the higher levels of well-being in those countries compared to these impoverished countries that link together in the lower left of the chart? Well, let's ask a different question. Within a country such as Norway or the United States, are rich people happier than not so rich, just moderately rich people? Or are people who drive a Mercedes to work happier than people who ride the bus? And again, we have, I could show you tons of data on this question. Ed Diener, who's the world's leading happiness researcher, the Jedi Master, I call him, of happiness researchers, has harvested data from the Gallup World Poll, and he illustrates what others have found. Namely, again, there is some positive correlation between income and well-being. This is a general well-being measure here, but as you can see, it tapers off with increasing income, just as satisfaction, life satisfaction tapers off. Once you get to $40,000 per person a year, for example, the association of increased income with increasing well-being kind of tapers off. By the way, economists have recently done a funny thing with that. They show you more of a correlation, but it's because they present not real income, but income in log dollars or log economic units. And I don't know if you know the mathematics of power, but it has the effect of taking a curved line and straightening it out. I think real dollars are what people live with, not log dollars, and so it makes most sense to look at the actual dollars that we take to the stores in our pockets. Moreover, there's some striking data that shows that people at the extremes of life circumstance don't vary by as much as you'd think. At one extreme are people who've won a state lottery, or won the pool in Britain, or been named as one of the 100 richest Americans, 49 of whom actually responded to a survey that Ed Diener did, partly because he has some connections. And in all these cases, these super, newly rich or super rich people, particularly after a time of adapting to their newfound wealth, report slightly greater than average happiness, but pretty much the same mix of emotions that you'd find in any cross-section of, say, 49 people. People who win $1 million in the lottery are euphoric for a while, but then they adapt, they recalibrate around their new level of affluence, and the emotions that marked their lives before return. At the other end of the continuum are people who live challenged by disabilities, who've been paralyzed in car accidents, or students who live with significant disabilities, and who have typically reported for themselves and been perceived by their friends and family as nearly equal to the average happy person. I mean, they're close to the average in happiness. This is dramatically illustrated in this study of medical patients who rate their quality of life as mostly satisfactory or good. And who are they? They are German ALS patients who suffer the progressive disease, the neurological destructive disease of ALS, which is about as horrid a disease as you can imagine. And yet, they manage to adapt to their situation, and most of them to retain a reasonably positive outlook on life. By the way, there's a new meta-analysis or statistical digest of ALS patients that has just come out. I just ordered it, and I meant to try to actually have it in my hands before I came here. We'll see if it confirms that. Or here's another study I came across recently. By the way, I showed you these data earlier from my state of Michigan. Somebody down in Nicaragua put those same faces to 99 impoverished trash pickers, people who scour the rubbish dumps trying to find food and stuff to exist. And he asked 99 of these abjectly poor people which of these faces describes how they felt about life as a whole. Well, they're not as happy as Michiganders, but still, Two-thirds put some variation, 70% almost, of a smiling face to say how they felt about life. Thirdly, and this is a really interesting question, we can ask whether the happiness of a people rises with their affluence. Does a rising economic tide lift the morale of the people in a country? There are data from different countries, but I have the most up-to-date and complete data from my own, so I'll show it to you. Here's what's called the disposable personal income. It's income after taxes, after inflation of Americans. And as you can see, over the last half century, it's tripled. That's real buying power. Now, it's tripled partly because of increases in real wages during the first half of that period. It's tripled partly because of increases in non-wage investment income, which hasn't trickled down to all levels of the population, so we have greater income inequality. And it's tripled partly because of the doubling of married women's employment over that time period. But the composite effect of all that is we've got two or three times as much money per person. And thus, lo and behold, we have twice as many cars per capita today as what we did a half century ago. We eat out in restaurants 2.5 times as often, and we've got all the cool technology that blesses our lives. We have air conditioning in our homes, which we didn't used to do a half century ago. Very few homes did. We have a daily shower, which to our grandparents was a luxury. We've got smartphones. We've got laptops with cool technology serving us right now. We've got post-it notes. I love being alive in the 21st century. Would anybody like to go back half a century and give it all up? We'd be miserable. And yet, are we any happier? Again, this shows our income. Now, this is the percentage of Americans who say they're very happy over time. And as you can see, it's essentially flat. Moreover, another recent study took 8,000 people and tracked them over 15 years. And you can see the blue line, their income was going up, but their happiness was, again, just flat. So this was a longitudinal as opposed to a cross-sectional study, as I showed you previously. Here's some data from other countries that's kind of interesting. Before the Arab Spring uprising, Gallup was in some of those countries. For example, in Egypt, income was steadily rising during the last half of the last decade. But meanwhile, while income was going up, the percentage of people that described themselves as thriving was going down. And that psychological unhappiness foretold, as it turned out, the uprising in Egypt. And ditto in Tunisia, which underwent the same experience. Rising income, diminishing psychological well-being of its people, and a revolution. Have you ever felt that you were going to have a nervous breakdown? Over the 40-year period from mid-50s to the mid-90s, Americans came to have a lot more money and became significantly more likely to say that they felt like they were on the verge of a nervous breakdown. And in fact, there's research that shows that children of poverty are at risk for certain kinds of pathologies, such as juvenile delinquency. But teens from affluent families, from really wealthy families, are at greater than average risk for other forms of pathology, for anxiety, depression, substance use, and eating disorders, for reasons that are being debated. Perhaps related to achievement pressures, greater isolation from adults. Or look at these data from the People's Republic of China. The Gallup organization did nationwide surveys in China in 1994 and in 2004. In 1994, they found that fewer than half of people had a color television set, only a quarter had a refrigerator, and virtually nobody had a phone. So they went back 10 years later, and now most people had a phone, most people had a color TV, about half of people had a refrigerator. Hey, this was great. I mean, tremendous material progress in China. And people who visited Beijing, for example, in 1995 and come back in 2010 say it just looks like a different city. All the wealth that's on display there and all the high rises that have gone up and so forth. And by the way, I tell people in Michigan, I'm in a manufacturing state. We make cars and things like that. And we've had the very high unemployment the last decade because so much of our labor has been outsourced to China. And I say, if it's any consolation, it maybe have been bad for Michigan, but it's great for China. And hey, people in China are people too. So let's celebrate that and their economic growth. It's still a poor country. It's just not as abjectly poor as it was back in the early 1990s. So the question is, are people happier in China today? Has economic growth improved human morale there, even though it didn't do so in the United States and in the European countries that have been studied? Well, back in 1994, half of people described themselves as satisfied, and only 12% said they were dissatisfied with life as a whole, or with how things were going in your life today. In subsequent surveys, Gallup forced them to answer one of those two questions. And watch what happens to the yellow bar over time. Remember, people are getting more stuff, but they're also getting less satisfied. And what's happening there, and by the way, other surveys of life satisfaction in China, these are just other data points. You don't have to make any particular sense of this, but they're all finding the same thing, level or decreasing life satisfaction in China. So I'm just, that finding has been replicated. What seems to be happening is you've got more, but the people around you have got more too. And so the comparison doesn't necessarily benefit you. And in fact, inequality has increased in China. And so it's easier to find somebody now who has a lot more than you do to make that comparison and to feel relative deprivation. Economic inequality in the country, you'll be happy to know since your country is internationally reputed for its equality, is associated with all kinds of problems as well as lack of overall well-being in the country. So bottom line here from this happiness money research seems to be that people think that a lot more money would make them a lot happier. In fact, it only makes them a little happier. And we call this difference here the affective forecasting error. And the fact that reality doesn't live up to our expectation is partly because of the social comparisons we're making with others whose boats are also rising, and it's partly because of our natural tendency to adapt to whatever are our circumstances. Which, by the way, also means that if climate change or whatever requires us to simplify our lives in the future, we could probably, with initial pain, adapt downward as well as upward, recalibrating our experience around what we have. And this principle is making it out into the kind of public sphere now, even to the cartoonist, money won't make you happy, Waldron, so instead of a raise, I'm giving a Prozac. And it's making it into the sustainability literature, as people are saying that we need to redefine our progress in an era of climate change, from thinking it in terms of materialistic terms, having to do with material well-being, undergirded by unsustainability, and in fact, redefine progress and quality of life in more mental, social, and spiritual terms that can be sustainably lived. Well, just a couple more things, and very quickly. One, there are some traits that mark happy lives. We're looking for this guy on the right who says, I've always been happy, but lately I've turned it up a notch or two. Who is this guy? Or, by the way, the Onion satirical magazine in the United States satirized these annoyingly happy people who need a drug like Despondex. Could be just right for you. It's to bring the people with mania down to a normal level. Happy people tend to like themselves, as I mentioned before. Self-esteem matters. They tend to feel a sense of personal control and empowerment, have an internal locus of control rather than an external locus of control. They believe they can choose their destinies. They tend to be optimistic rather than pessimistic. Pessimists are people who, when bad things happen, make internal attributions. They think it's all about me. There's nothing I can do about it. It's going to affect everything. Whereas optimists have a different way of explaining negative events, disappointments, failures in their lives, and going on from that. And finally, they tend to be outgoing, to be extroverted rather than introverted. By the way, here's an illustration of that from Purdue University students that shows the greater self-rated happiness of extroverts than introverts. You also get an interesting day of the week effect. You guys seem to be in really good spirits this weekend. And Friday night for students is a happy time. And in fact, it's a happy time for most people. A researcher who has a connection to Facebook shared with me privately and allowed me to publish what I think is the biggest data set in human history from billions and billions. He wouldn't, for his proprietary information, so he wouldn't tell me how many billions of data points are this. But what he did is search for the appearance in Facebook status updates of positive versus negative emotion words by day of the week. And as you can see, Friday and Saturday are happy days. Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday, people use more negative emotions in their Facebook updates. By the way, it's also true of the emotion words used in 509 Twitter messages harvested across 84 countries. And again, here, by the way, here's Friday. You can see 6 p.m. I'm glad we started an hour late here, Cinder, because people get happier and happier as the evening goes along. Okay, one more thing here, and then we'll take our pause, is social support. We do know that close relationships are a predictor of health, of freedom from ill health, and of life expectancy. And we also know that close relationships are associated with happiness. People who have close, supportive, intimate friends who meet their, whose need to belong, as we call it now, is met, are more likely to report being happy. That being so, what do you think is the correlation between marriage and well-being? Here are data from approximately 50,000 randomly sampled Americans showing the percent of very happy married adults over time and of never married adults over time. And as you can see, that's a substantial correlation between marital status and well-being. By the way, other data look at the percentage of very happy people as a function of how happy their marriage is. If somebody's married and that marriage is not very happy, they're not very happy. If it is a very happy relationship, it colors their life, it seems to, and they're happy. By the way, we're just talking correlation here between marital status and happiness. It's a real correlation, but it could be because marriage satisfies the human need to belong when it works, and that's satisfying. Or it could be because very happy people are more socially attractive and enjoy more stable relationships than do less happy, depressed people who tend to have unstable relationships. And in fact, there seems to be two-way traffic between marriage and happiness. By the way, out of some of this research has come what I think would be very useful for those of you who are seeking professional degrees in clinical psychology, a therapeutic lifestyle management program by Stephen Ilardi at the University of Kansas that puts people through a six-week training program, giving them coaching and teaching and so forth and reading material related to the benefits of aerobic exercise, adequate sleep, light exposure, prioritizing their social connections, controlling their ruminations, and eating a healthy diet. And the effect he finds is substantially reduced depression for those who've undergone that program. That was a little more than 30 minutes. The first one was a little less than 30 minutes, so we're on our 30 minutes here. Now I suggest we take that 5-minute break and then come back and have a little conversation. And then if you'll give me another half hour, I'll get you out of here by 10:15, if that's good, okay?